So thank you so much for the invitation to be here. You know, I am a tissue engineer. I'm a bioengineer. I'm not a stem cell biologist, although we do a little bit of stem cell biology in my lab. But I know that the that my title out there was off-the-shelf engineered arteries, and I am going to talk about that in the first part of the talk. But as I was thinking about what I should talk about this morning, I really thought it would, you know, maybe be more interesting for this group to take you through the thought process that folks who are trying to make whole functional tissues, as opposed to differentiating individual cells, folks who are trying to make whole tissues using cells as building blocks, the thought processes that we have to go through to do that. Because it's really fundamentally different from the approaches that are taken in what has been this enormous and wonderful field of stem cell biology. So I do have a conflict of interest. I'm a founder of Humacyte. I have stock. When I'm showing Humacyte data, there's going to be a little Humacyte logo in the corner, so you'll know. This is one of my favorite slides that I actually use in a course I teach every year. One of my first graduate students, a very talented woman named Shannon Dahl, was once talking about our lab's approach to regenerating arteries, which is what we were doing at the time, and some other groups. And she talked about the difference between tissue engineering and tissue try this. and tissue engineering is what I like to think we're trying to do. Which is a rational combination of cells and biomaterials and culture conditions, all with the goal of trying to develop a tissue that's functional. And a tissue that's functional is not always the same thing as a tissue that has cells that are expressing the right markers. Those are actually two related things, but they're different things. And I'm going to sort of walk you through a few examples of that today. So one thing that my group has been working on now for about 20 years is trying to engineer functional arterial replacements. And this has the development of engineered arteries, which we've now brought to the clinic, was not a straight line. And I'm not going to give you all the left and right turns. I'll show you one or two turns that we took. But the product development was certainly not a straight line. But as many people in the audience know, vascular conduits are moderately complex. They have an inner layer of endothelium, which prevents blood coagulation. There's a muscular wall that allows for contractility. The smooth muscle cells in the wall secrete extracellular matrix, which creates mechanics. And then there's a loose adventitial layer. Arterial disease is the most important thing. It's still the biggest killer in the United States and in much of the Western world. And replacement arteries are needed for hundreds of thousands of patients a year, both for coronary bypass and for things like dialysis access, where we have to connect an artificial blood vessel between an artery and a vein. So I'm going to talk a little bit now about mechanics of blood vessels. And if you reduce the mechanical considerations of an arterial wall down to very, very simple terms, you can really think about arteries as being made up of three things, cells and elastin and collagen. And if you're an engineer, you think about how strong each of these components is when you're trying to understand the whole mechanical behavior of the wall. And when engineers think about how strong something is, they talk in terms of modulus, which is really just sort of an index of strength. So the modulus of smooth muscle cells in the wall is about a megapascal, which is actually a fairly small number. The modulus of elastin is about 3, and the modulus of collagen is about 100 megapascals. And what that means is that of all the components in the arterial wall, it's really collagen that confers the vast majority of the very high mechanical strength that our blood vessels need. And I want you to hold that thought in your heads for a minute, because I'm going to come back to that concept in a few slides. So when we began trying to figure out how to engineer arteries from scratch, which is an undertaking that we started in the mid-1990s when I was still a postdoc at MIT, the paradigm that we settled on, which actually has been something that we've extended now across 5 or 6 species, is to use a rapidly degradable polymer scaffold that's made of a highly biocompatible material. It's polyglycolic acid. We would seed vascular smooth muscle cells onto it, and we would expose the cells to a combination of biomechanical stimuli, cyclic stretch, which mimics the cyclic stretch that occurs in native arteries. And we would also expose the cells to growth factors, which were known even 20 years ago to be very important for vascular healing and remodeling, specifically transforming growth factor beta, PDGF. So we gave them the right sort of growth factor cocktail, the right mechanical environment, and we also gave them the right biochemical environment. If you're going to ask cells to make a lot of matrix so that they make a mechanically strong vessel, you have to support that collagenous matrix production with the right stuff, like the correct amino acids and small amounts of copper so they can do cross-linking. So it's really, when we were trying to design a set of criteria in the laboratory that would coax cells to make an artery that was functional, we really had to pull on not just sort of the cell biology, but also the biochemistry and the biomechanics. And we had to pull all that together into the bioreactor system to allow us to provide enough cues to these cells so that they could grow and then form what was a confluent tissue. Our first demonstration of the feasibility of this approach was actually published in Science in 1999, so it was 15 years ago. What we did was we took bovine and then porcine cells. We seeded them on this rapidly degradable polymer, and then we would grow it in a bioreactor, grow a little vessel. After 8 weeks, the polymer was largely dissolved. We had cells, an extracellular matrix, smooth muscle cells, an extracellular matrix. We'd then seed endothelial cells on the lumen, and then we'd implant that into animals. And we, our first experiments were autologous, where we took cells from a pig, grew an artery, and then went back into that same pig. And we followed those vessels for a month. And that was very exciting at the time because these things functioned as arteries. They were mechanically strong enough to work as arteries. But they did take a long time to grow, and we were only growing them for pigs. So as we began to think about, you know, now that we had some initial feasibility, as an engineer, I began to think about the design criteria. And this is a theme I'm going to come back to over and over. So, if you think about what the gotta-haves are for a functional engineered artery, you know, I would argue there's probably three. You've got to have stupendous mechanical properties because your arteries actually have to distend and recoil about 3 billion times over your lifetime. And if an artery ruptures, that's usually a bad outcome. So your mechanics have to be really superb, and that comes from the matrix. You have to have low thrombogenicity. So particularly at small diameters, you have to have a good endothelial layer or else your graft is going to clot. And if there's cells in the graft, they probably have to be autologous or else the vessel will ultimately reject. So these were the design criteria that we went into this problem with in the late 90s, thinking, okay, these are the gotta-haves. So as part of trying to address the autologous cell source issue, by this time I was a faculty member at Duke, and we set up a collaboration with some cardiac surgeons, and we said, okay, when you're doing a bypass on patients who need new arteries, typically what they do is they take a piece of vein out, and they often have extra. So at the end of the bypass operation, they would page my student. My students would run over, grab the vein, culture the cells from the veins from these patients who have this atherosclerotic disease, and try to culture arteries that were functional. And in fact, what we found was that smooth muscle and endothelial cells from old sick humans, amazingly enough, don't grow quite as well as smooth muscle cells from young healthy cows. And we actually spent about 4 years fiddling with these cells, trying to do some gene therapy, extend their lifespan with telomerase. We did a bunch of stuff. And in the end, we were kind of stymied. And so we went back and we started thinking about our design criteria and thinking about how we can engineer our way around some of these problems, because the whole autologous cell source thing was becoming a real issue. So we started to rethink our approach. And we decided to focus instead on mechanics. And mechanics are derived from collagen, as I've mentioned. And you know, collagen is a really important structural molecule in your body. If we dried you all down, 17% of your dry weight is collagen type 1. It's really an important molecule. It's so important that it's very tightly evolutionarily conserved. So what we realized was that perhaps we could take cells from a young, healthy donor, use those cells to grow an artery of the proper mechanical properties, and then wash the cells away so that we could get the right mechanics, solve this problem, but we wouldn't have cells in the tissue that would reject. So that's the general approach we decided to take. As far as the thrombogenicity issue, for our first clinical application, we decided to focus on larger caliber vessels, 6 millimeters roughly, and those vessels are less prone to thrombosis because blood flow rates in those vessels tend to be pretty high. So while going back to our design criteria, we had to take another look at them after 4 or 5 years and say, if I want to get to something that's functional in a human, this is how I have to sort of engineer my way around. And so this led to spinning out Humacyte in 2004 now, early 2005. And the concept was that we would take banked human smooth muscle cells, use these to grow engineered arteries in our bioreactors. We used to have these old glass bioreactors that would grow little tiny arteries. Our current bioreactors, it's arbitrary how big the vessels are, but our current vessels are 42 centimeters in length and 6 millimeters in diameter, so they're pretty good size. We would grow these things for 8 weeks under pulsatile conditions with a lot of the same biochemistry that I just mentioned. And then we would decellularize them. And by doing that, we produced a graft, we hoped, that would be mechanically robust, non-living, so you could store it on the shelf. Suddenly you don't have a living tissue that you have to rush across the country in 24 hours. Now you have something that you can store for 6 or 12 months in the hospital. And the hope was that it would be non-immunogenic, thinking that we had removed enough of the cells. So here's just a little bit of what these things look like. So when we wash the cell, this is a scanning electron micrograph of a cut cross-section of a vessel wall that's been decellularized. You can sort of see all the pores there where the cells used to be. And actually, these pores repopulate with host cells. I'll show you that in a minute. The mechanical properties of things were very high. I'll just point out this number. The burst strength of these arteries is well over 3,000 millimeters of mercury, which is about 30 times your blood pressure. And although that sounds like it's over-engineered, it's actually not, because that's around the rupture strength of your native arteries. So it's a very, very high bar that you have to clear in order to make a tissue that's going to be mechanically functional in the arterial system. So when Humacyte was thinking about where are we going to first test these things, we decided to first test them in dialysis patients. And the reasons are multiple. There's a lot of patients. There's a huge clinical need, just exactly what CIRM is trying to address. There's a huge clinical need there. There's 400,000 patients. And currently, if they use a Teflon graft, a PTFE graft for dialysis, if you put one of these grafts in, 50% of the time, after 12 months, it's failed and they need a new one. So these poor patients have to go back to the hospital all the time for repeated operations. And the reasons these fail are because of clotting and intimal hyperplasia and infection. And so our hope was that a tissue-based graft might be less subject to some of these failure mechanisms, although we didn't know at the time, and we're still finding out. But it was clear that there was a huge clinical need, and so we were trying to address that. But in addition, patient safety was a real concern for us. You know, if an artery ruptures, if it's in the wrong place, like on your heart, that's a bad outcome. That's a fatal outcome. Even in the worst case scenario, if one of these grafts ruptures, your patient pretty much can't bleed to death. He'll get a big swollen arm, but you're not going to kill your patient. And for us, that's a really critical thing if you're going to go in with a brand new technology into the human. So as far as how to test engineered arteries that are made of human matrix, that's actually non-trivial. We first tried to test them in pigs and dogs, but the immune response was too vigorous against the xenogeneic collagen. So we wound up going to baboons, which are an old world primate, and phylogenetically pretty close to human. And we did a very similar human-like operation, where we took our engineered decellularized human arteries and sew them in between an artery and a vein in the upper arm of the animal. And we followed them for between 1 and 6 months, and we did this in 14 animals. And every couple months, we would poke these things with large bore needles to simulate dialysis. And that was kind of the closest we could come to the human experience. So we implanted 14 animals. We had an 83% overall patency rate, which is actually pretty good considering the difficulty of this model. So, you know, baboons have opposable thumbs. And that means that if your surgeon closes the wound with stitches that the baboon can get at, sometimes on post-op day one, you walk in and the wound is open and you're looking at the graft. It's a challenging environment. So anyway, but it taught us a lot. It taught us a lot about how these things function and how they repopulate. So this is an H&E stain of the graft before it goes in. After 6 months, this is a graft that's explanted from a baboon. This is a stain for smooth muscle alpha actin, showing that it's become extensively repopulated with autologous smooth muscle cells. If we look at the lumen and stain for CD31, which is an endothelial stain, we see it also repopulates on the lumen. And if we do a stain for collagen type 1, what we see is that the collagen itself, in fact, is extensively remodeled after 6 months. So what I think is going on here, and the reason that why these findings for me are so exciting, is that I think that what we're witnessing is regeneration in the truest sense. Because we're starting off with a non-living template, which is probably contains a lot of the proteins that are in native arterial matrix, and the host perceives that as native arterial matrix and repopulates it as such. And so after 6 or 9 months, what we've got is not what we put in, but it is regenerated host tissue. And for me, that's very exciting to think about. So just to remind you about the clinical need, so grafts made out of Teflon do pretty poorly. If you look at follow-up of grafts at 1 year in large clinical series, only about 50% of them are functioning. So we developed actually a total of 3 phase 1 clinical trials, 2 in dialysis and 1 in peripheral vascular disease. The first, we've done 2 of these trials in Europe, in Poland, and we've done another trial in the US. All 3 of these trials are completely enrolled for a total of 80 patients. But the first patients were implanted in December of 2012 in Poland with dialysis access grafts. A total of 30 and then 40 patients were implanted in this trial. And then another 40 were implanted, 20 in the US and 20 in a peripheral vascular disease trial in Poland. And for the primary objectives, obviously for a phase 1 trial, you're thinking about safety. You know, does the thing mechanically fail? Is it immunogenic? Is it inflammatory? You know, are there other issues? But also, once we put these grafts in, after 4 or 8 weeks, they would be accessed with needles for dialysis 3 times a week. So these things are getting poked with large bore needles and put on the dialysis machine 3 times a week. And I can tell you that the first 2 patients who were implanted in December of 2012 have been using their grafts for dialysis for almost 2 years. This is what it looks like. These grafts are tunneled underneath the skin, put in the upper arm. This is the venous anastomosis, the arterial anastomosis. This is the graft here being sewn sort of end to side, which is a standard surgical procedure. And this is some clinical data that we showed actually at the American Heart meeting last year. Unfortunately, all the clinical data I'm going to show you is from this meeting. We've completed enrolling these trials and we're writing up the results right now, but I'm not at liberty to talk about them. So I have to show you year-old clinical data. And for that, I apologize. But what we showed a year ago, and all the messages are still generally the same, is that at that time we had 28 patients who were implanted in the dialysis study, and their function at 6 months, the functional patency was 100%. If you're looking at Teflon, but by 6 months, typically 20 or 30% of these grafts have already failed and needed to be replaced. So even from this early data, it looks like our functional patency in these grafts is considerably superior. When we looked at development of panel reactive antibodies, which is an antibody that is developed against MHC class 1 antigens, we did not see an increase in patients who got our grafts. The grafts did not mechanically fail. They didn't dilate. This is the diameter in millimeters over time. Going out in some patients past 9 months, the diameters are stable. And the flow rates in these grafts are very high, over a liter a minute, which allows these patients to have dialysis successfully. So this has been a very sort of encouraging story for us. It's taken a long time to get here. I'm now approaching 20 years on working on this project. So these timelines are not short, unfortunately. But by paying attention to design criteria and by trying to think about what aspects of function we really needed to build in, I think we were able to be successful. So I'm gonna branch away now, and I'm gonna talk about two other tissues that we've been working on. And my title is 2 years, 2 months, 2 hours. And the reason I put that in the title was that I first wanted to show you a tissue that in our hands has been working for roughly 2 years. And that was the engineered artery. In that case, we were able to, by hook or by crook, sort of make our design criteria. In the other two tissues I'm going to show you, the trachea is actually something that's completely unpublished. We've been working on that for 3 or 4 years now. This is only the second time I've talked about this project. But I'm going to show you data on that that shows you that our engineered tracheas don't last for 2 years, but they do last for 2 months. And then in the end, I'm going to talk about engineered lungs, which in our hands so far only last for 2 hours, and how well things work. In vivo depends on how well you're meeting your design criteria. So let me walk you through the trachea story. So as an anesthesiologist and intensivist, I've lungs and airways are very close to my heart, and I had wanted to regenerate tracheal tissue for a long time. So the clinical demand for trachea is not as large as for blood vessels. You know, there's about 4,000 tracheal resection replacement operations that occur every year, as opposed to hundreds of thousands in the vasculature. But you know, trachea is pretty important. You know, you gotta breathe, you know? So those 4,000 patients who have real airway issues, who need airway replacement tissue, I mean, this is the very definition of a pressing clinical problem. So tracheas are interesting in that like many tubes in the body, they contain a smooth muscle cell wall, but they're engineered a little bit differently, because whereas arteries have to withstand external pressure and distension, tracheas have to withstand compression. And that's why you have these cartilaginous rings in your trachea, is so that your airway doesn't collapse every time you take a deep breath in. So the cartilaginous rings are sort of a C-shaped thing, and they stent the airway open. But the rest of the airway is made of smooth muscle and the extracellular matrix that's made by the smooth muscle and fibroblasts in the wall. In addition, the trachea also has a fairly complex epithelial lining, which stems from basal cells, which are sort of the local progenitor cell of the airway. And these cells line the entire trachea and give rise to ciliated epithelium and all the other types of epithelium in the airway. So a very influential tracheal surgeon named Hermes Grillo, who died a few years ago, who I had the privilege of working with at the Mass General, Hermes Grillo essentially invented all of what is now tracheal surgery. And he was the acknowledged world leader for decades. And in 2002, he wrote a review paper where he enunciated essentially what the design criteria would be for a functional tracheal replacement. He said the tracheal replacement has to be laterally rigid. You can't compress it. It has to have respiratory epithelium. It has to have airtight anastomoses, because if you leak stuff from your trachea into your chest, that's bad. That's bad. That kills the patient. It has to integrate into host tissue, has to be capable of remodeling and microvasculature. You don't want to immunosuppress the patient, and you have to be able to implant it easily. And he said in 2002, so far no tracheal replacement has met these criteria. So there has been a lot of press about tracheal replacements, and I know that some of the people who've been at this conference, you know, are very involved in that. I'll just show one slide on that. So this is an example of a completely synthetic material that's been repopulated with autologous cells and has been put into patients. And some of the clinical results are a little mixed. Sometimes they get good outcomes, sometimes they don't. I'm not going to dwell on that too much, but I will say that people have gone recently from sort of material to very minimal animal studies and straight into man. And what we have seen is that the clinical outcomes have been mixed, in part because they haven't been paying attention to all the design criteria, and in part because not a lot of large animal work has been done. Several years ago, we essentially did a modification of our engineered vessel strategy. And what we said is, if we want to make a stented tube instead of just sort of a vascular tube, what if we used a clinical grade metal stent and embedded it in our polymer and then grew cells all around it so that the tissue encases the stent and that we're sort of mimicking those cartilaginous rings? So we kind of fiddled around with that for a while, and we figured out how to do that. So this is an example of five different 6-millimeter diameter tracheal stent composite tissues. At the end of culture, we then decellularize them so they're non-living and they can go into anybody of the same species. And this is just an example of a 4-millimeter tracheal stent that's destined for a rat. And this is a 16-millimeter engineered tracheal stent that is of a proper size for human tissue reconstruction. So we can do this at multiple length scales. If we look at these decellularized tissues, which if you cut through them with plastic embedding, what you can see is that by H&E, there's a lot of extracellular matrix that's been synthesized. You can sort of see where the struts of the stent were in this section. We looked at the mechanical properties of these tissues, and we did some mechanical testing both for compression and for tension. You know, do these things collapse? Do they tear when we pull on them? And we compared those mechanics to native trachea. So in tension, what I can tell you is that the tensile strength is pretty similar to native. In compression, the compressive modulus of the engineered tracheas is actually higher than native. So these things are a little bit harder to compress than native trachea. They're a little stiffer. And that's something that we can tune by tuning the stent, but this is sort of where we landed first. We also looked at whether these tissues would rapidly stimulate angiogenesis, because tissue incorporation and healing and angiogenesis that will allow the immune system to get in and fight infection is incredibly important for successive engineered tracheas. You know, tracheas are in contact with the world. You're breathing in bacteria and mold all the time. So you really need a really dense microvasculature so that the host can deliver immune cells and prevent infection. So we did a CAM assay looking at angiogenesis. And essentially what we saw is that this material is highly angiogenic. And I can talk a little bit afterwards about why I think that is. But it's a highly angiogenic material. So that was somewhat comforting to us. So then we went back to Hermes Grillo's design criteria, and we said, okay, you know, have we cleared the bar here? And the answer is kinda. So we have a tube that's laterally rigid. We do not have a respiratory epithelium. This is naked matrix. We believe that we could form airtight anastomoses based on our preclinical studies or our benchtop studies. We believed it would probably integrate because of the microvascular infiltration. We did not anticipate need for immunosuppression, and we thought that this would probably be pretty implantable. So we worked with some surgeon colleagues at Yale, and we started implanting these both in rats, and also we did a small number of implants in non-human primates. And we used different species of matrix in the rats. We used rat and some bovine. In the non-human primates, we used a human matrix that encased the stent. And we followed these things up for between 2 weeks and 2 months. So the data's a little mixed. So I would say that in all the primates and in about half the rats, we had really good outcomes. Really good outcome means that at the explantation point, the tissue was not infected, it was well integrated, it was well recellularized. When we looked at these things by histology, there was a lot of rapid cellular infiltration, even starting at 2 weeks. You can sort of appreciate the beginnings of an epithelial lining on these scaffolds after 2 weeks, and there's a lot of host connective tissue that repopulates it starting at 2 weeks, and then it's very dense after 8 weeks.
And this is where all the struts used to be. From our monkey studies, it was very interesting to see that an explant at 2 weeks showed sort of a primitive cuboidal epithelium on the lumen and a lot of host cell repopulation. But after 8 weeks, looking across again from a piece of stent material here, I would argue that this is probably indistinguishable from native epithelium. So we know that basal cells in the airway can activate and proliferate on airway injury and are also fairly migratory. So I think what's happening here is that basal cells from above and below the implant are crawling onto the epithelial surface and giving rise over a period of weeks to a highly organized columnar epithelium that even has goblet cells. When we looked for evidence of angiogenesis in the wall, we saw a lot of it after 8 weeks. This is some data in a rat showing that we got a lot of microvascular tubes staining for both smooth muscle and endothelial cells. So if we kind of stand back and look at the data from the rats and the primates as a whole, following these things out to 2 months, what we saw was, I think in part because of the rapid angiogenic response, the rapid healing, we didn't really see any instances of perforation or leakage or infection. That's a really good thing not to have because those complications are fatal. We did see epithelial repopulation, even though we didn't go in with epithelium. In many cases, we saw evidence of a lot of epithelium over time. But I will say that in some cases, we did get a less desirable outcome that I'll show you here. So in half of our rat explants, when we took the tracheas out, they kind of looked like this. But in half of them, they looked like that. And they were very stenotic. And these graphs actually had very little evidence of epithelial repopulation. And there is some evidence from the literature that says that the epithelium may exist sort of in a dynamic tension in the airway, and that the presence of epithelium actually prevents fibrosis and stenosis. And for these airways, we may not have gotten enough epithelium quickly enough to suppress that stenotic response. So this is definitely a work in progress for us. You know, we recognize that we met a lot of our design criteria, but the lack of lining of respiratory epithelium may be hurting us. It may also be hurting us the fact that these things are a little stiffer than they should be. But the good thing for us is that these are things that we can directly test by experiment and modulate. So again, this is, I think, just another example of the concept that by thinking hard about the problem initially and by deciding what your goals are, your amount of success in vivo will largely be driven by whether or not you're meeting those goals. So the last thing I'm going to talk about is lung. So regeneration of an entire lung tissue is a Herculean project, many decades. We've been at it now for about 7 years, and we've made a little bit of progress. So the lung is the thing that, in our hands, works for 2 hours. 7 years gets us 2 hours of function. So we still got a ways to go. But I'll talk a little bit about sort of lung function in general and about what we think our design criteria are and about how many of them, you know, how close we are to hitting those. So lung is fascinating. It's a huge surface area for gas exchange in the lung, which is the lining of all of our alveoli. It's about 70 square meters. It's about as big as this room. And what's amazing to me as a physician is that we're all sitting here breathing 10 to 12 times a minute, and every time we take a breath in, we take in enough gas to cover this entire surface area, and then we breathe it out, and we do it all day, every day, our whole lives, and we never get tired. And that's amazing. And the reason we never get tired is because, in addition to this big surface area, the branching structure of the airways is uniquely designed so that the resistance to airflow and the turbulence is very low. Lungs are also incredibly compliant. It just takes a couple millimeters of mercury pressure to completely inflate a lung. So you don't have to do a lot of work to bring the air in to cover a surface as big as this room. So when we started thinking about, you know, how do we engineer a lung that's going to exchange gas, which is its primary function, You know, I probably did mental experiments for 5 or 6 years trying to think about how can I make a biomaterial that's going to have all these properties. And I decided I probably couldn't. So we took this decellularization approach again. And what we decided to do, this is just a little thing here. So what we were trying to make is something a little bit more elegant than the iron lung. You know, the polio epidemic, I mean, that was a big deal. In the 40s and 50s, there were huge hospital wards. Hundreds and hundreds of these things lined up. It was actually frightening. And so, you know, here we are at the Salk Institute. But what we're trying to do is get a replacement that's maybe a little bit more elegant than this. And so as a means of generating a scaffold that would be suitable for lung regeneration, we took this decellularization strategy, which I'll show you in a minute. But again, thinking about kind of what the design criteria were going to be for lung, we needed an adequate surface area for gas exchange. So we needed to recapitulate and maintain all of these alveoli with all of their septae and the microvasculature that surrounds each alveolus, which allows the lung to exchange gas. We needed a barrier between blood and air, because if you have blood flowing through the lung, and if blood flows into your air sacs, that's called drowning. You don't want to do that. And you need to have proper mechanics. It's got to be compliant. It's got to be easy to breathe. The patient can't get tired. And the cellular components have to be autologous. Otherwise, you're going to all this trouble to make an allogeneic lung, and heck, we do lung transplantation now, so why bother? So when we decellularized lungs, we started our work with rats, but we've moved now to pig and human. Most of the data I'll show you is with rat. When we decellularize rat lungs, if we do it carefully and well, we can maintain the alveolar structure, and we can also maintain the microvascular structure. So these are casts of the airways, and this is the left pulmonary artery in a decellularized rat lung. So we developed a paradigm after spending 2 or 3 years trying to work out sort of an initial method of decellularization that didn't disrupt all these alveoli. We developed a paradigm where we would decellularize lungs, mount them in a bioreactor, and then repopulate them with vascular endothelium in the pulmonary artery and with pulmonary epithelium, mixed epithelium, into the airways. We would culture them for about a week, and then we would either look at them in vitro or implant them in vivo into a different recipient. So I know I'm running out of time, but I've just got a few more slides, so I don't think I'll run over too much. So this is just some histology of some early efforts at acellular lung repopulation. This is an H&E slide of a native rat lung, and this is decellularized and repopulated. The primary difference here is that there's red blood cells in the microvasculature here, but for the engineered lungs, we don't perfuse them with blood, we perfuse them with culture media, so you don't see that. If we look at the mechanical properties, the compliance of these lungs, I'm not going to dwell on this too much, but I will say that the engineered lungs have in pressure volume curves which are not that different from native, which is a good thing. When we repopulate the airway with epithelium, it's actually an interesting problem because the epithelium in the airway is not all like the tracheal epithelium that I showed you before. It actually changes going down the different airway branching structures. So there's columnar cells proximally, there's cuboidal clara cells in the mid portions, and then there are type 1 and type 2 alveolar cells that line the alveoli. And it was a big source of worry for us because even though we could inject cells into the airway, we really had no idea where these different cell types would go, and we were injecting initially a mixed cell population. So I'm going to take you through some reseeding results that we observed. So starting at the bottom of the lung, this is in the rat model where we're taking mixtures of lung epithelial cells and injecting them into the airway and allowing them to adhere and culture in a decellularized lung. When we did a stain for type 1 cells, which line the alveolus, that stain is in red here. It's for aquaporin 5. What we found was that native looks like this, and in some good areas of repopulated lung, it kind of looked like this. When we stain for surfactant protein C, which is made by type 2 cells, which kind of sit in the corners of the alveoli, native lung looks like this, repopulated lung looks like this. And we did not see these cells, either type 1 or type 2 cells, in the larger, more proximal airways. When we looked for Clara cells, which are sort of in the mid portion of the lung, in the medium-sized airways, medium to small, native lung looked like this, repopulated lung looked like this. And again, not all small airways look like this, but we did not see Clara cells in the more distal parts of the lung. So what we observed was that by carefully decellularizing the matrix, we had actually left a lot of substrate signals which defined which cells landed where. Not perfectly, but actually moderately well. And so one of the hardest parts of our job was actually done for us by this pre-made lung matrix, which actually had a lot of spatial information, had a lot of zip codes already in it. This is just an image of repopulated endothelium in the vasculature. What I can tell you is that this is a CD31 marker. This is native, this is repopulated. Our endothelial repopulation is something that is okay, but it's not great, and I'm going to show you data which shows you why it's not great and why it's something we really need to work on. But we do occasionally even get tight junctions forming between two endothelial cells, which helps with barrier function, helps keep the lung from flooding. So after 4 or 5 years of sort of benchtop work, we embarked about 3 or 4 years ago on some rat implantation studies, where we would take the native left rat lung out and put in an engineered lung. And when we did this, what we saw initially was that the lung would inflate and exchange gas. These are some blood gas values taken from the pulmonary artery and pulmonary vein. In this case, the pulmonary artery contains venous blood. It contains deoxygenated blood. Pulmonary vein contains the oxygenated blood, so it's a little backwards. But essentially, you can see that blood oxygenated in the engineered and native lungs both very well, and they both blew off CO2, which is great, and the lung inflated and filled with air and looked fairly fabulous. And that continued for about 2 hours until we got this. And what we got after 2 hours, what happened is the engineered lung essentially started to become extensively clotted. And when we took it out, we saw a lot of microvascular thrombosis. And so what we found we had done was repopulate this lung with a fair amount of epithelium, but the endothelial repopulation was really insufficient, leaving a lot of exposed basement membrane and a lot of places for clots to form, which ultimately kept the lung from functioning. And frankly, that's been a technical issue that we've been banging our heads on now for a couple years, and we've actually made a lot of progress. But repopulating the microvascular with endothelium is actually a tough thing. But we're making headway. So if we go back and look at our design criteria, if a lung is going to have adequate surface area for gas exchange, it's got to have those alveoli. But these little capillaries in here, those have to be patent. If they're clogged up, you ain't got surface area for gas exchange. So we really weren't making that. We also weren't maintaining an adequate barrier between blood and air. You know, if you'll notice, you know, we had some blood cells in these airways. Not good. So clearly not perfect there. The lung has to have proper mechanics. We actually think we were pretty good there. And the cellular components of the lung have to be autologous. And there we're about a quarter of the way there, I would say, both in rats but in humans. I'll just show you, I'm going to show you exactly one stem cell slide to finish up, and then I'm done. So our group, along with about 3 or 4 other groups, has been working on different developmental paradigms to try to derive different types of epithelium from human iPS cells, because ultimately the vision here is that this will be an iPS-driven therapy. The key is to differentiate enough cells and in enough numbers to repopulate a whole human-sized organ. This is just showing some phase contrast images of taking human iPS cells, one particular clone, all the way through a 28-day differentiation that ultimately gives us cobblestone cells that express a large number of markers of type 2 cells in the alveoli. So we are making progress here, but again, I'd say we're about one quarter of the way there. How many cells do we need? Just to remind you, lung's a big organ. These are actually pig lungs in a human-sized bioreactor. hundreds of billions of cells. Hundreds of billions of cells. Hundreds of billions of cells. It's a lot of cells. It's a lot of cells. If you're talking about real organ reconstitution. So that's it. I'm done. So we've got a really terrific group in my lab that's worked on the lung and the trachea stuff now for 4 or 5 years, longer than that. This work has been supported by the Heart, Lung, and Blood, as well as Connecticut Innovations, sort of the local Connecticut small version of CIRM. And then these are the folks at Humacyte who did all the vessel work, also partly supported by Heart, Lung, and Blood and the Defense Department. And I'll take any questions. Thank you.